To get us thinking about the topic for this morning, I want to start with a couple of questions. First one is real easy. They might get harder after that, but the first one is kind of easy. The first one is are you happy? Are you happy? Now, I know what some of you are thinking. Let's see how the message goes, and then, you know, then I'll decide. Or some of you might be thinking, well, you know, are you talking about like right now, or are you talking about generally? I'm just talking about generally. There is actually an academic peer review called the Journal of Happiness Studies, and I'm sure we're paying for it, tax-subsidized study, but they actually try to use research tools to figure out what it is that makes human beings flourish, what it is that produces joy. And what is striking is that when they look at what distinguishes generally happy people from those who are less happy, they discover that there is one factor, one difference that consistently separates the two groups. And the second question is, what do you think that factor is? So just turn to the person next to you, just give them a wild guess, tell them what you think that singular, that one factor is, and then I'll tell you. Got your answer? You ready? Well, it's not income. I'll tell you what it's not first. It's not income. I saw this someplace. After $60,000, the difference that money makes with regard to human happiness is zero. It's not health. It's not what shape your body is in. It's not attractiveness. That's good news. It's not IQ. Further good news for me. It's not career success. It's not security. Are you ready? What distinguishes consistently happier people is the presence of rich, joy-producing, life-changing, meaningful relationships with other human beings. In other words, spending time with family and friends and people who care about us is absolutely indispensable to human well-being. A guy by the name of Gary Putnam, who wrote a book, I don't know, it's probably at least a couple decades old now, called Bowling Alone, you might remember it. He said this, "The single most common finding from a half century of research on life satisfaction is that happiness is best predicted by the breadth and depth of one's social connections." In other words, meaningful, life-giving relationships. Or what can also be called connectedness. But don't misunderstand. Connectedness has nothing to do with knowing a whole bunch of people. Nothing to do with like racking up a lot of friends on Facebook. And some people get confused about this because they have lots and lots of contacts, but maybe no friends. They have lots and lots of conversations, but no real connections. Let me give you kind of a picture of connections from Scripture. Paul, when he was writing to his friends in Ephesus, he talks about how they can be connected to the Father, and then how they can also be connected to the family of God, because they're brothers and sisters. We can be like brothers and sisters. And then he explains what's going on, and he says this. He says, "You being rooted and established in love." And it's the picture of a plant, or shall we say a tree, for the purposes this morning. When a tree puts down roots in the ground, those roots then are able to take up nutrients and water. And the tree grows, and it has life, and it has strength. But only if it's what? Rooted. And in a similar way, Paul is saying that we are rooted in the love of God in other people. When people care about you through words, through touch, through prayer together, through compassion, through risk and vulnerability and then acceptance, when there's an exchange of genuine caring, it's like the roots of your soul are getting fed and then coming up into your life and your being and making you strong. And every life needs that connection. And you can actually test this a little bit. I read this somewhere, and so I actually tried to test this myself. It's the idea, if you're just walking down the street, you know, maybe you're taking a walk somewhere, and someone comes up to you, and they're smiling, and they just say, "Hi," that does something for your soul. You walk away with a little bit more joy just because of that little momentary connections. And that's just one little... So next time you're out walking, just do that test. Just pay attention and see what happens. Near the end of his life, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who wrote the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, penned a poem called Youth and Age. And he reflects, on the passing years and the physical effects of growing older. And he has this great line. He says, "Not cared this body for wind and weather when youth and I lived in it together." In other words, when you're young, it's bring it on, right? Wind, weather, doesn't matter. Snow, hail, sleet, rain, icy snow, blistering heat, it doesn't matter. But then as you grow older, you discover what Coleridge eventually realized, and he has this great line. This is the one I want to focus on. He says, "Friendship is a sheltering tree." Think of friendship as a sheltering tree with deep roots and leafy branches that spread themselves around us and shield us from the summer blasts of adversity and the winter winds of loneliness. But here's the deal. Deeply rooted, giant, leafy, sheltering trees don't grow overnight. They need to be planted. They need to be watered. They need to be rooted. They need to be established, in the words of Paul. And no one knew this better than the apostle. Now, if you don't mind, turn to 2 Timothy chapter 1. That's where we're going to be this morning, both in the first chapter as well as the last chapter. Now, what we're doing, and Matt explained this last week, we're doing kind of a little mini study series in between. We've come out of summer and we did Who Is This Man? In a couple of weeks, we're going to go back to the book of Hebrews and spend some time there again up until Christmas. But we're doing this little series, and we do this every couple of years or so. We come back to sort of, important issues and part of our DNA as a church. And you can see it. Oh, did we take the slide down? Can we throw that back up there? Kate? Or maybe not. First slide. Has that been up there at all? Okay. No, that's not it. That's it. There we go. Life entwined. There we go. And we talk about these three things that are part of our life. Connecting to God, living in community, engaging the world. And we just come back to those things. Now, if you go on our website, we've changed the language a little bit. It talks about finding God. And Matt talked about that last week and how God finds us. And then at the end, it says making a difference. And we're actually going to talk about that next week. We have a Jim Martin, who is a vice president of spiritual formation from the International Justice Mission, is going to fly all the way to D.C. and come and talk to us about the 45 million men, women, and children that are violently exploited by slavery around the world. And we're going to talk about that and how we as a church are making a difference in that area. But this morning, it's in the middle. It's called Be a Friend. Find God, make a difference. This morning, we want to talk about what it means to be a friend. That's the topic. Now, there are lots of different and good examples of friendship and life-giving relationships in Scripture. There's Jonathan and David. They're the ones that, when they were young, they made that covenant with each other, to be BFFs forever. Certainly, there was Naomi and Ruth. Your God will be my God. Where you go, I will go. Jesus and his disciples, just not long before the cross, he said, "No longer do I call you servants, but friends." And just before the cross, three chapters before the cross, Jesus says, "This is the word. This is the language that explains the kind of relationship that we have. We are friends." But there's another example of life-giving, joy-producing relationships in 2 Timothy. Now, some of you know this, some of you may not. 2 Timothy contains the last written words of the Apostle Paul, as far as we know. He's in prison for his faith. He's been in prison before, but this may be the last time. Because not long after this letter, on an April morning in 68 AD, Paul was taken 3 miles outside the city of Rome, where he knelt and prayed. And then, with the glint of cold steel in the morning sun, the little apostle of grace breathed his last breath on earth and entered into the presence of the Lord that he had served so faithfully. And Paul evidently is convinced that he won't survive, and so with a sense of urgency and purpose, he shoots off kind of this four-page letter, this little note to a young man for whom he had deep affection. And the letter starts as follows, verses 1 and 2. Paul, an apostle of Christ Jesus by the will of God, according to the promise of the life that is in Christ Jesus. You can tell right from the first line, he's not expecting to survive. And then he says to Timothy, my beloved child, or my beloved son. Notice that Paul calls Timothy his beloved son or his beloved child. Now, Timothy was not a biological child. As far as we know, the Apostle Paul never had any children. Instead, this is an expression of how Paul felt about him. Timothy was a young man when Paul met him in the city of Lystra and led him to Christ and then took him under his wing and began to build into his life. They went on missionary trips together, and over time, Paul became like a father to him. Paul at this point is probably about my age. He's 65 years old, and Timothy is probably about 35 years of age. And Timothy actually became one of the pastors of the church in Ephesus. And in Philippians 2, Paul writes of Timothy, he says, I have no one like him. And this close relationship explains the purpose of the letter. As Paul peers ahead to the finish line of his life, he wants to pass on the baton to his beloved son in the faith, and he's going to remind Timothy to run with it. And in a sense, he's saying, this is what's important, Timothy. Keep going. Don't stop. Don't quit. Don't drop the baton. Don't give in. Don't give up. It's kind of a little cheerleading letter. It's like a cheerleader. And every life needs a cheerleader, right? We live by encouragement, and we die without it, slowly, sadly, and angrily. One of my granddaughters, she's not here, maybe she'd be in the second service. One of my granddaughters is a cheerleader. And so I said to her, you know, Ashton, you're a cheerleader now. Wouldn't it be great if on Sunday mornings, just before I got up and taught, you would come up and you would do like a little cheer for me? And she says, I don't think it works that way, Grandpa. And I said, well, you're a cheerleader, but maybe I could be your cheerleader, because the cheerleaders need cheerleaders. And so before you go, I will go out and I will do a little cheer for you. She said, I don't think it works that way, Grandpa. So that's not going to happen. So it's a letter of encouragement, but Paul also encourages Timothy with it in a prayer for his life. Look at verses 3 and 4. He says, I thank God whom I serve, as did my ancestors with a clear conscience, as I remember you constantly in my prayers, night and day. As I remember your tears, I long to see you that I may be filled with joy. Now, that prayer is all the more poignant when you realize that Paul is feeling lonely and isolated and abandoned in prison. And absolutely everything has been taken from him except for two things. One is time, and the other is memories. And as he passes the days and nights in prayer, he has this stabbing ache in his heart. He longs to see his friend, and he remembers the tears streaming down Timothy's face the last time that they said goodbye. And when you said goodbye to someone, to a Christian in the first century, especially someone like the Apostle Paul, you knew that it might be for the last time. Someone has said that following a Christian in the first century was like following a wounded deer in the snow, just constant trails of blood. And that is, in fact, where the trail will end for Paul. But the thought of Timothy's tears, the hope that he might see him one last time, was the only ray of sunlight in the darkness of that dungeon. He says, I long to see you that I may be filled with joy. A man who was blind, born blind from birth, was once asked what he thought the sun looks like. And he says, the sun looks like my friends. Well, here's the first lesson. Relationships like these, like between Paul and Timothy, don't just happen. They take time, they take attention, they take an initiative over many, many years, sometimes decades. And it is a tragedy that our lives are so busy, so filled with diversions, that we're often, we've stopped taking time to build long-term, strong, tear-stained relationships. Mike Iaconelli, years ago, in a magazine called The Wittenberg Door, he said, we have opted, in my opinion, for slick, strobe-lighted, lip-gloss Christianity in place of dirty, risky, tear-stained, long-term relationships. We have allowed others to become images rather than friends, people we know rather than people we love. So here's the question. If you had to pull up stakes and had to move to another state, who would shed tears over your departure? And who would pray for you every day? What made Paul and Timothy's relationship so strong? Well, there was raw time, of course. As far as we know, this is about a 15-year relationship at this point. But there was also commitment. Paul expects Timothy to come to him. Chapter 4, verse 13, he says, when you come, not if you come, but when you come. Well, wouldn't that be dangerous? Well, yeah. I mean, not only was it dangerous to travel in the first century, but Paul's not in prison for a parking ticket. And to actually come and visit Paul while he's in prison could be toxic to your own life. And when you face a crisis, that's when you discover the value of true friends. Steve Brown writes this. He says, my mentor and good friend, Fred Smith, says that you make enemies quickly, but you make friends slowly and very carefully. Isn't that so true? In other words, you learn to test your friends. He says, this happened in Fred's life. A pastor friend was accused of a horrible crime, and Fred got on the phone, called his friend, and he said, I don't want to hear if you're innocent. I don't want to hear if you're guilty. I just want to hear if you want me on the next plane out to stand with you as my friend. That's friendship. And he says, the principle is this. It is only on the other side of crisis that you discover friendship. Now, in light of what Paul has said at the beginning of the letter, it's no surprise what he says at the end. And his last words begin with a final wish. Go all the way to chapter 4, if you don't mind. And we want to look at verse 9 and verse 21. Verse 9, he says, do your best to come to me soon. And in verse 21, he says, do your best or make every effort to come before winter. The hope of Paul's heart, his final wish, is that Timothy would come to see him. And traveling in the ancient world from Ephesus to Rome is no picnic, no walk in the park. You can't catch a plane or a bus or a train. You had to go over land, you had to go over sea. It was dangerous for all different kinds of reasons. It also took 3 or 4 months to get there. But verses 10 and 11 explains why the need is so great. He says, for Demas, in love with this present world, has deserted me. That had to hurt. Apparently the world got to Demas, maybe got tired of, you know, being near Paul in prison, maybe the potential of his own life being taken, we don't know, but he left. He's gone to Thessalonica, Crescens has gone to Galatia, Titus till Dalmatia, probably actually for good reasons, probably sent there by Paul unselfishly to help some churches. And then in verse 11, he says, Luke alone is with me. And so one reason Paul so desperately wants to see Timothy is because taken all together and then subtracting out those who have deserted him or departed, there's only one person left that he can lean on, and that's Dr. Luke. Out of all of his close friends, there's other friends around, but out of his closest friends, only Dr. Luke was with him. Luke, you remember, he's the physician that would travel with the Apostle Paul when he got sick or he got beat up, which was often. Then Luke was there to get him well and help bind up his wounds. And now at the end of Paul's life, as far as we know, Luke stayed with him on death row until the very end, until the very day of his execution. I want to pause for just a minute, and I want to read a page out of a book by Gordon MacDonald called The Resilient Life, A Resilient Life. And he's writing, it's near the end of the book, and he writes about, it's in a chapter called The Value of Lingering, and he makes the observation that his daughter and her husband had these friends that they just spent volumes of time with, and they just lingered together and just spent a lot of life together. And Gordon and his wife began to notice, you know, we don't have relationships with like that, and we're kind of entering the mid-course of our life, midpoint of our life, and we need to make some changes about how we're living. And so he says this, and it's a little bit long, but it's good. That chapter and these pages I'm going to read to you changed my life. He said, further examination convinced us that most of the relationships we did have were based on who had problems and needed fixing, who was staffing or leading the programs at the church, or who was on the program at some conference where one or both of us was speaking. We concluded that this was not a healthy way to live, and if we didn't change, there would be undesirable consequences as we pointed toward the second half of life with all of its vulnerabilities. Recognizing this, we set out to build some of what Christy identified as, and that's his daughter, lingering friendships. He says, over the years, I have come to call this special group of people the happy few. The happy few. A phrase lifted from Shakespeare's The Life of King Henry V. In his attempt to rally his beleaguered English troops who would face the French in the Battle of Agincourt, Henry spoke of a band of brothers, where that came from, we few, we happy few. And he said, in thinking through what a happy few might look like, I saw the need for some close male relationships, and Gail and I recognized a further need to bond together with some married couples on a regular basis. And he says, let me emphasize that we did not have in mind tea circles or supper clubs. We came to believe in the importance of something like an extended family where there would be a deep commitment to meet with one another regularly, to share life and its challenges, to help each other find out what God was saying to us. The resilient life, this long-distance race, is not possible without such personal community. One cannot meet all the needs there are for deep human intimacy within the confines of a marriage alone. We're going to come back to that. And he says, there must be others with whom the journey is shared. In fact, if we ask a marriage to provide all of our needs for human intimacy, the marriage may droop under the weight of excessive demands. And then he asks this question. Who are the happy few in our lives? He says, brace yourself for the answer that we came up with. The happy few are ultimately defined as the people that we want to die with. Now, at first, I thought that was kind of funny. I'm not sure I want to get in a car with him. You know, was he talking about a car wreck or what? But he explains. He says, all of us connect with people with whom we work, people with whom we live in our neighborhoods, and people with whom we serve and worship in our churches. But these tend to be connections that are like the waves of an ocean. They rise, foam for a moment, and then are gone. With the dramatic increase in the pace of life, most relationships are short-lived. But in the midst of all this wildness, there must be a happy few who walk with one another, as it were, all the way to the grave. Who do you want to die with? Here's another lesson. When life gets tough, you need tough friends. When life gets tough, you need tough friends. There was no one tougher than the Apostle Paul. The little guy was made out of catgut and piano wire. He was tough. But he still needed friends. And so do you. And I don't care how capable, how independent, how self-sufficient you think you are, you still need friends. And you need to be that kind of friend. Friends that are committed and faithful and caring, who won't cut and run when the going gets tough, like Demas. And people who will come when you call, like Timothy. Now look at verses 19 through 21, very end of the letter. This is what he says. Greet Prisca and Aquila and the household of Onesiphorus. Erastus remained at Corinth, and I left Trophimus, who was ill at Miletus. And then he says it again, do your best. He says, make every effort to come before winter. And then he adds a few more names. Eubulus sends greetings to you, as do Pudens and Linus and Claudia and all the brothers. On the last page of his final letter, Paul is still remembering his friends by name. I mean, that was the beauty of the Apostle Paul. He had both breadth as well as depth in his friendships. And then he makes that last appeal. He says, make every effort to come before winter. And the question is, did Timothy make it to Rome before the apostle died? And the answer is, we don't know. We don't know. Evidence shows that Paul was probably executed in the spring of 68. This letter was written in the fall of 67. And so Timothy actually had time to reach Rome from Ephesus and be with Paul in the last weeks of his life. But we don't know. But in my wildest imagination, I can't imagine that Timothy wasn't on his way. The friendship of Paul and Timothy is the way it should be in the body of Christ. We're already brothers and sisters. We need to be friends. And so the question is, who is your sheltering tree? Maybe even hopefully you have a little forest, right? Who is your sheltering tree? Who are those happy few, the faithful, caring friends who won't cut and run when the going gets tough, who will come when you call? Who do you want to die with? But sheltering friendships don't just happen. They need to be planted and watered, rooted and established in love over time. There's a guy by the name of Simon Sinek, and the name is spelled S-I-N-E-K, but I think it's pronounced Sinek, and he's got some videos out there that have just gone viral, just gone crazy, and he writes especially about millennials. If you go to YouTube, you look up Simon Sinek, and you just go millennials. This little talk that he gives is about 14 or 15 minutes long. It's written to millennials, but it applies to everybody. And if you want to find out why I am still untethered and do not have a cell phone, listen to that video. And I will collect all your phones next Sunday. But he makes this, and he says this is a problem for millennials, but it is a problem for everybody. He said this. He says, we live in an age where we can have everything instantly. We can have everything instantly. You need something, go on Amazon, right? You can have it the next day. You want to see a movie? Click on a button. You can see a movie anytime you want. Instant gratification. And he says you can have everything instantly except strength in relationships. He says there's no app for that. And he says they are a slow, meandering, uncomfortable, messy process. Nevertheless, everyone needs close, committed, meaningful, life-giving relationships, even pastors. A guy by the name of Jack Connell wrote a book called Ministry Mulligans, If I Could Do It All Over Again. He says, at some point in our final month of pastoral ministry, Wendy, his wife, suggested that I cancel a golf game with some buddies so that she and I could take a long walk at a nearby lake and talk about a few things. Uh-oh. The look in her eyes told me that this was more of a command than a suggestion, so I reluctantly canceled my game and readied myself for a trip behind the marriage woodshed. After we chatted about some of the logistics related to our upcoming move, she said, Jack, there is one more thing. There's just one more thing. I braced myself. Jack, you're wrapping up the first half of your life. You're at halftime. And my hope for you is that in the second half of your life, you'll do the friendship thing a whole lot better. Of course, I got all defensive. What do you mean? I have lots of friends. I preached a sermon on friendship once. I could be playing golf with three friends right now. And what she said next found its way into my journal that night. But you keep all of your friendships in the safe zone. You don't take off your pastor mask and let people have access to the deep parts of your soul. The wheels were coming off in the last year, and you didn't let anybody know. You can't go on like that, Jack. We all need true friends, even you. And then he says, and so I pushed her in the lake. Henry Nouwen said that too many of us are lonely ministers practicing a lonely ministry, and I was one of them. I had 1,000 acquaintances, not one real close friend, and if I could do it over again, I'd make an all-out assault on my pastoral isolation and make room in my life for authentic, transparent, life-giving friendships. I'd seek friendships with other pastors. I'd spend more time with my neighbors. I'd be more vulnerable with people I could trust in the congregation. Maybe I'd buy a cat. He didn't say that. He said, maybe I'd buy a dog. But I know I would follow more closely the example of Jesus, who lived with his disciples in such a way that he could call them friends. Now, some of you, mostly men, are thinking, but my spouse is my best friend. Well, good for you. Your spouse should be your best friend. But you need other friends outside of your spouse. Let me explain why. This is what a wife wrote in her diary. Tonight, I thought my husband was acting weird. We had made plans to meet at a nice restaurant for dinner. I was shopping with my friends all day long, and so I thought he was upset at the fact that I was a bit late. But he made no comment on it. Conversation wasn't flowing, and so I suggested that we go somewhere quiet so we could talk. He agreed, but he didn't say much. I asked him what was wrong. He said nothing. I asked him if it was my fault that he was upset. He said he wasn't upset, and it had nothing to do with me, and not to worry about it. On the way home, I told him that I loved him, and he smiled slightly and kept driving. I can't explain his behavior. I don't know why he didn't say, I love you too. When we got home, I felt as if I had lost him completely, as if he wanted nothing to do with me anymore. He just sat there quietly and watched TV. He continued to seem distant and absent, and finally, with silence all around us, I decided to go to bed. And about 15 minutes later, he came to bed. But I still felt that he was distracted and his thoughts were somewhere else. He fell asleep. I cried. I don't know what to do. I'm almost sure that his thoughts are with someone else. My life is a disaster. The husband in his diary said, a two-foot putt. How the heck do you miss a two-foot putt? Greg Heath sent that to me a couple weeks ago, and I just knew I had to work it into a sermon somehow. But remember what Gordon MacDonald wrote? One cannot meet all the needs for deep human intimacy within the confines of a marriage alone. There must be others with whom the journey is shared. Now, we started with a question. I'm going to close with the test, and I'm going to put up six questions for you to answer. You can answer right where you are seated. You don't need me to pencil and paper. You want to put up the first question, Kate, for me? Here we go. When someone goes wrong, do I have at least one friend I can easily talk with about it? And just yes or no. Okay, we're going to go through these kind of quick. Next one. Do I have a friend I can drop in on at any time without calling ahead? Yes or no? You don't have to answer out loud. We're going to ask for a show of hands at the end. No, I'm just kidding. Third question. Is there someone who could accurately name my greatest fears and temptations? Yes or no? Do I have one or more friends whom I meet with regularly? Yes or no? Do I have a friend I know well enough to trust their confidentiality? Yes, no. If I receive good news like a promotion, do I have a friend I would call immediately just to let them know? Yes or no? So here's the deal. Some of you can say yes to most of these questions. Some of you can say yes to most of these questions. Good for you. Some of you cannot. If you can't say yes to most of these questions, you may want to join a life group. Consider that, some kind of small group in our church. Or, you know, just even start, invite someone out to coffee as a first step towards friendship. If you can say yes to most of these three questions, then you may want to lead a life group. You have some capability there. You're already ahead of the game. And we need some folks to continue to lead life groups. Or you could join, ask someone out for coffee as a first step to connecting. Why do you want to do that? Robert Putnam made a staggering comment. He says, as a rule of thumb, if you belong to no groups, but you decide to join one, you cut your risk of dying over the next year in half. It's difficult to imagine anyone not being interested in cutting their risk of dying in half. That's why we changed the name to Life Groups. And that's why our motto is, join a group or die. One last thing. John Ortberg in Everybody's Normal Until You Get to Know Him. Says there is a little volume called The All Better Book in which elementary school children try to solve some of the world's naughtiest problems. What to do about the ozone layer, how to help people stop smoking. But here's the toughest. With billions of people in the world, someone should be able to figure out a system where no one is lonely. What do you suggest? And then these little kids answer this question. This is Kalani, age 8. People should find lonely people and ask their name and address, and then ask people who aren't lonely their name and address. And when you have an even amount of each, assign lonely and not lonely people together in the newspaper. And he said, obviously, this is a girl with the gift of administration. Max, age 9, said, make food that talks to you when you eat. For instance, if you say, it would say, how are you doing? And what happened to you today? Another little guy by the name of Matt, age 8, said, well, we could get people a pet or a husband or a wife and take them places. And he says, but the most touching response is the one that can break your heart. And it comes last. Sing a song, stomp your feet, and read a book. And sometimes I think no one loves me, and so I do one of those. And then Ortberg goes on, he says this, with billions of people in the world, someone should be able to figure out a system where no one is lonely. And somebody has. And that someone is God. And that system is community. And that community is the church. That's us. That's me. That's you. He says, God's plan is for no one on this earth to be left out. Being connected in meaningful relationships is life-giving in the most literal sense. But it won't happen unless we're willing to be a friend. See, it's not enough just to be a friendly church. We ought to be a friendly church. But we also want this place to be a place where people can make friends. But it's not going to happen unless we're willing to be a friend. And it starts in your little hood, your little neighborhood, wherever you are, but it doesn't stop there. In John 15, just before the cross, Jesus said, "Greater love has no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friends." And that's what Jesus did. He not only came when our need was desperate, but he laid down his life for his friends. That's you. That's me. And that's what we remember at this table. We should also follow his example. You think about that.